I'm your host, Benjamin Levesay, and for the next hour, I'd like to invite you to grab your cup of coffee, tea, or Diet Dr. Pepper, if that's your beverage of choice, and settle in for the 11th episode of Fiber Hooligan. For those of you who are wondering who the heck I am the CEO of XRX Inc., home of Knitters Magazine, XRX Books, and Stitches Expos, and I'm broadcasting live from our offices here in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. So we took the week off last week, and had a nice, relaxed Memorial Day, but I have to tell you, I missed you all. I'm going to try not to do that very often because I get out of the habit of getting myself going on Monday and making sure that I say hello to all of you in the world. But it was a good time. I hope you all had a wonderfully restful Memorial Day weekend. We had a blast. So let's get into the show today. I have a great guest today. My guest today is a designer, a teacher, an entrepreneur. She's a Craft Yarn Council certified teacher. She teaches at many venues, including Stitches and throughout the country, and is also the author of Entree to Entrelock from XRX Books. Her designs can be found in a variety of knitting magazines and through her own business, knitability.com. She is one of the best speakers and communicators I have ever met, with the ability to mix good, practical information with humor in a way that is immediately accessible to anyone who listens to her. I'm speaking, of course, to my good friend, Gwen Bortner. Gwen joins us today from La Grande, California. Good morning, Gwen, and welcome to the show.
Thanks, Benjamin. Good morning to you. And you say such nice things about me. It always makes me feel good. I don't blush that easy, but I think I may be blushing a little bit. It's hard to know.
Well, you're
I've already got a tan, you know.
Well, I wish I had a tan. It's overcast today. Is it beautiful
Benjamin,
there?
It doesn't matter. You wouldn't have a tan anyway.
I know. I'm so white, aren't I? It's just terrible. I glow in the dark. It's terrible. So do my kids. Well, you met my kids. They glow in the dark, too. But I say nice things about you because you're really gifted. I mean, I've seen you up on stage many times, and I've watched your classes online and you know, snuck in the back door of your classes at Stitches. You know, you're extremely fun to watch, and I think that anybody who's had one of your classes or has seen you in person or on Craftsy would say the same thing.
Well, I'm glad. I mean, because that, to me, that's part of what I'm doing, because we're not, you know, teaching how to solve world hunger. We're teaching knitting, and it really should be fun and somewhat entertaining. And so I'm hoping that it will be fun and entertaining, you know, as well as educational when folks come into class.
I hope so, too. So I am so happy to finally have you on the podcast. I just feel like it's been remiss. It's 11 episodes before I could get you on. I don't know what was wrong with me. Before we get going in today, how are things there? How's your wonderful husband?
Well, Arliss is, you know, my phrase for Arliss is best husband ever, and I've been starting to abbreviate it, and one of our mutual friends, Stacy Trockhunter, said, oh, is that an official acronym? And it's like, well, it is for me, so, you know, BHE, best husband ever. So he continues to be BHE, and we've been working on a big project here at the house, and he's been also not only best husband ever just in general, but he's been best husband digging out pipes and filling in things and fixing things and pulling out tree stumps and, you know, all sorts of craziness going on here.
So he's what did Red Green used to say, if they women can't
Ooh,
find
you can't
you
be
handsome,
handsome, be handy.
Handy, right? But he's both, right?
Well, yeah, he is. He is. He's a very good-looking man, but he is extremely handy. So even if, you know, he has some major, you know, disfiguring accident, he'll still be handy. So that's good.
That's good. Well, there you go. And I gotta ask about your dog, because you're somebody that has a history of having big dogs. You only have one dog now, but it's a Dane, right?
It is. We tease her, though, about it, that she is a Dane, but she's not a Great Dane, because she's kind of petite. We kind of tease her about being a petite Dane and not a Great Dane, which means she's only 100 pounds.
Oh, my. Yeah, my dog is starting to move up closer to that, too. I think there's Dane in my dog. I can't believe that there's
Dane. You know, I've looked at all the pictures of her on the web. When you post them, and, you know, she is just adorable. And because I have had several Great Danes now, Zeph is now my third, I would say that I would say she has some Great Dane in her. She's got some facial features to me that say Great Dane, as well as the giant paws and the, you know, just overall good sizedness of her. How old is she now?
I think she's 8 months.
Okay, yeah. Zeph will be two.
It's 8 months and about 80 pounds.
Yeah, Zeph will be two next Monday. And so,
oh.
So she's as big, you know, she's as big as she's going to be. We know, you know, pretty much what her end game is. And she really is tiny for a Great Dane. But, of course, anyone who sees her is like, what? She's huge, you know. These are people who own Chihuahuas and stuff. You know, they're
yeah.
just...
Yeah.
They don't get
yeah.
it.
They don't get it. They don't get
they
it.
They don't get it.
No. No. All right. Well, and everything's cool with your mom and dad?
Oh, yeah. Mom and dad are good. Last weekend, we actually went up to our cabin in the Sierra Mountains, which is in Kings Canyon, which is a lovely place. And we got it open and encouraged mom and dad to come up with us, and because they didn't even make it up once last year. And so they came up and hung out with us, and dog sat while we went for a hike, and you know, all of those things. So yep, they're in good shape as well.
Yeah. Well, great. So now we got all of the, you know, because you and I don't talk enough. We only see each other at these shows, and then it's always work.
Actually, it was so nice last show. You and I got a chance to just chat, which
we did.
Never happens. I mean, it really was lovely. I don't think I had a chance to say it a second time, but it really was. It was just lovely to sit and chat with you for a little bit during the kind of less than busy time, which is hard to find at a show.
Yeah, but it was. But that you're right. It doesn't happen that often. Yeah, it was good. And you were around that Sunday night, which was awesome. That just sort of spontaneous get together. That was pretty great too.
Yeah, no, that was fun in the typical insanity that has become
typical insanity.
Yeah, on a Sunday evening.
All right, we won't make our listeners feel jealous about not being there. So we'll get right into talking about you. All right.
Well, maybe so, they should just come, and then they could be there
they
too.
They should just come. If Fiber Hooligans, did you hear that? You just have to, you know, get on.
You just
a plane
have to come to a Stitches event and plan on staying through Sunday night.
That's
there
right.
You are. That's all there is.
That's
to
right.
It.
Yes, you'll probably find us in the bar at least once.
Yeah, or somewhere near it.
Somewhere near it. Okay. All right, let's talk about you. Let's talk about your personal history. You did not get started in this industry. You came from the world of IT. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I did. I actually have a degree in computer science, and I started working professionally as a computer programmer during my sophomore year of college, which is fairly amazing, mostly because I had never touched a computer before I got to college. So I wasn't one of those that had, you know, been playing with computers and whatnot through high school and all. I had to take a class. I went actually to college to be a math instructor, and that was my plan, at least. And I had to take a computer science course as part of that degree. And my instructor pulled me aside toward the end of the first semester and said, I want you to take these set of courses next semester, because if you want to stay a math instructor, you'll need, you know, these will all be applicable, but I think you really should be a computer science person. And continued to do really well in the computer science courses. And then at the beginning of the next semester, he helped me get a job, and I started working professionally. And my very first client was General Mills of, you know, Cheerios fame. You know, so it wasn't just a little tiny thing. I was working for big companies, working as their primary programmer on some projects. And so I continued to do that. For a brief period in college, I worked at a yarn shop, and that was where my real interest was piqued in someday being in the fiber industry, but I also knew that it wasn't an industry where you can easily support yourself. as a single, you know, person of the age of, you know, 22 coming out of college. So, and I also knew that my dad would just go apoplectic if, you know, he'd paid for private school, no less, for a computer science degree and I didn't use it. So, so I continued on in my computer science career and had my own consulting company for a while and then worked for another consulting company, which then led me to working for Ernst & Young as a computer small business consultant. Eventually that led to working, running the IT department for a startup competitive phone company. And when I left that business about 12-ish years ago now, I was vice president of IT operations for Birch Telecom out of Kansas City. And so I did kind of the whole major IT career. And then when I left that career was when I thought, this might be a time I could try this whole knitting thing. And that was when Knitability was formed.
Well, along the way, your fascination with numbers is one of the ways that got you going with the yarn store owner that you met and worked for. Can you tell us that story? That's because that's a great story.
Well, the reality was, as I went to work for this yarn shop, I didn't actually plan on working there. I was just had discovered that for myself, if I was knitting in class, no less, well, especially in class, I actually was getting better grades. I was so focused when I went to college, I knew exactly what I wanted to do. And so I actually took all my general education courses my senior year because I had been so focused, I hadn't done any of my general ed. And in my general ed courses, when I started knitting, I was working on a project, a big long black scarf for my 6'4" friend that he wanted down to his knees. And I was working on that project before Christmas. And, of course, you know, that's a lot of knitting on black, no less. And I was working on it. It was getting close to deadline, and I could see I needed more knitting time. So I started knitting in class. And my grades in every single one of those classes went up a full grade. And it was like, well, that's interesting. And so I decided I should continue knitting, that it shouldn't just be, you know, because my friend wanted a scarf. And so the next thing I went to knit was a Lopi sweater. And I picked out yarn, because the yarn shop owner kind of pointed to the wall and said, pick out something over there. I was like, okay, and it was her brown sheep lamb's pride wall. And it's been around that long. Yeah, I know. Long time ago. And what happened is I picked out worsted weight instead of bulky weight, and because she hadn't really specified that. I just kind of picked colors I like. And she said, oh, that's okay. We can, you know, adjust the pattern. We'll recalculate the numbers. I was like, okay. You know, I had no idea what she was talking about. She said, sit down and knit some for me. I was like, okay. And so, you know, I knit up a swatch, basically. And then she took some measurements and she started doing some calculations, and I was watching over her shoulder just out of, you know, curiosity. And as I did so, I noticed that she hit the numbers wrong on the calculator. And I said, isn't that supposed to be, you know, whatever, 36 or 24, you know, whatever the number was supposed to be. And she looked at me and she says, what do you mean? I said, well, aren't you just multiplying this times this? And I said, you did a wrong number. It should be such and such, because like I said, I'd gone to school to be a math teacher, and so numbers were my thing. And she looked at me and she said, you can't possibly understand what I'm doing. And I said, oh yeah, sure, this makes perfect sense to me. And she's like, no one understands this. And I said, no. And she said, well, then you do this and I'll watch you. And it's like, okay. And so I finished doing all of the calculations, which included, you know, it was a Lopi pattern, so it included having to come up with the right pattern repeats to, you know, work for the stitch multiples for whatever patterns as the yoke was changing and doing the decreases. And it all worked out fine, and I went ahead and knit the sweater and, you know, worked for years and years and years and years because it totally worked. But she immediately wanted to hire me at that point because she did always make mistakes in the numbers. And it was something that they did at the shop, was actually offer custom pattern calculations like that. That was just one of their features that they did. And so it was a problem because she'd make mistakes. And so I started doing that, but of course also did sales and all sorts of other things. So I wasn't really a very experienced knitter when I started working at the shop, but boy, working at a shop makes you an experienced knitter really fast.
So there you were, and they had their own in-house math guru.
Right.
That was, you know, applying her understanding of numbers to customize things. That must have made you extremely popular.
It did. Well, and also I was novel because I was young. You know, this was back in, I graduated in 87. So this was probably, you know, 86, 87. It was toward the end of my college career. And although we were getting a surge at that point, much like we had, I don't know, 10 years ago or whatever that was, our last big surge, it was still really weird for everyone to see someone, you know, under the age of 50 in the yarn shop. So I was much as a novelty of, you know, being young as being able to do the numbers. And so it was fun. It was interesting. I mean, it was an interesting job and taught me about being in retail and working with the public and, you know, all of those things that I think are good experiences for everyone to have.
Now, was it in the yarn store that you first were introduced to the concept of entrelac?
It was, because the same yarn shop owner, who was an extremely experienced knitter, was very gifted, was amazingly creative, and had just, you know, fabulous design ideas, couldn't do entrelac. And now, you know, years later, after having taught literally thousands of people, I know the reason is that she was trying to outthink it. She was trying to outthink the directions, because the directions seem weird if you try and overanalyze them. If you just read to the period, do what it says, read to the next period, do what it says, and don't put words in or things in that aren't there, it's relatively straightforward knitting. And so she plopped this blob of entrelac down in front of me and said, "I bet your little weird twisted mathematical mind will understand how to do this." And so I just picked it up. And because I was a newer knitter, I didn't try to outthink the directions, because I didn't really know enough to outthink the directions. I just did what it said. And, you know, poof, here comes entrelac off the needles. And she was right about my weird twisted mathematical mind going, ooh. You know, I immediately got all into it and was going, this is going to be cool. And started playing with it almost immediately in doing other things that you could do with entrelac. Because there were a lot of entrelac designs, but they were all flat, rectangular pieces that were either seamed together or sewn in with, you know, other components. A lot of them were coming out of Europe. Annie Blatt was really popular at the time. And so most of those designs were coming out of Europe, and they were really cool designs. But the translation of European patterns was, as it is sometimes now, not necessarily great. So the instructions weren't always really clear enough to work from. But there were some great designs coming out, and it was like, but we could do more. And so that was me, my mathematical mind, you know, applying to the weirdness of entrelac.
Now, back then, you were teaching a number of things in the store as well, right?
Well, actually, I wasn't at the time. The first thing I ever taught was, in playing with the entrelac, this is, you know, totally dating myself, but I've already given away my age, so we were taking the yokes out of sweatshirts. We were taking sweatshirts, cutting the yoke out, finishing the edge, and then picking up along that edge and knitting a yoke back into the sweater.
I remember seeing that. Yeah.
I'm sure you do, because, you know, we're basically the same age, and you've been in this industry also a really long time. Not everyone knows that about you, but I know that you hopped away for a while, but you've been associated with this industry, well, your entire life, pretty much. And so, yeah, I knew you would remember this. And so I decided it would be fun to put an entrelac yoke in a sweatshirt, but this meant solving two problems of which I had never seen anyone apply an answer to. One was doing entrelac seamlessly in a circle, and also to get it to be shaped in, you know, the shape of a yoke of a sweater. And so I you know, decide a wool sweatshirt, how, you know, how bad could it possibly go? And so I gave it a go and actually came up with an entrelocked yoked sweatshirt. And we hung that in the shop just as a, you know, hey, look what you can do. I mean, there was no intention of doing anything with it, and everybody that walked in wanted to make that. So the very first thing I ever started teaching was how to do entrelock seamlessly shaped in the yoke of sweatshirt. And I taught that class just again and again and again because we just kept filling it up. Everyone wanted to make that particular sweatshirt.
I remember those were such cool things.
Well, and it still is an interesting phenomenon. And I had I think I finally got rid of all of them, but I was still wearing a couple of them not very long ago. I'd pull one of my old ones out because people would say, oh, what a pretty sweater. You know, really, you don't see anything above what would be, you know, the typical marble bust, you know, size of people. You look at their head and just a little bit below. And so just a little bit below was sweater. And so people would not notice that the rest of the sweater wasn't sweater, it was sweatshirt. And needless to say, you could knit those way faster than knitting an entire sweater. You know.
So eventually, how did you get into the whole teaching thing?
Well, so I kept teaching on and off, occasionally for a local yarn shop here or there, even while I was doing my whole IT thing. I mean, it was very, very rare. It was very, very random. It was just occasional. I had gotten interested in spending more time with my knitting as I moved into my last IT career and was still, you know, the whole time was very busy knitting and, you know, being involved in that aspect of a consumer. And when I laid myself off as part of why I left my job, I had a year's severance, and I looked at Arliss and I said, okay, I need to just do some stuff for me because it had been a crazy, crazy ride in this last job. And I said, I'm going to go to whatever knitting conventions I want to go to. And you won't believe this. No one that's listening will believe this, but I had really literally knit up my entire stash. I know. Don't pass out. You're probably,
wow.
I'm probably talking to nobody on the phone right now because you're probably passed out.
No, wow.
I know. Now, it wasn't that huge to begin with. It wasn't, you know, this ginormous, you know, 18 closets worth of stash. But I was working, you know, this was a startup company that I was working for. So I was working 12 and 14, you know, 16-hour days pretty much constantly. So getting to a yarn shop just wasn't happening. And so I would knit the stuff that I had gathered over time. And I'm sure were a few things left. But, I mean, the stash really had been knit up. So, yes, it is possible to knit up your entire stash. It really is. Mm. It's bizarre when it happens, but it is possible. And so I needed to restash. And I had a nice severance package, so I was going to use it. The first thing I went to was Stitches West, because I have one of my best knitting buddies was still out here in California, and Stitches West at the time was still in Oakland, and so not, you know, too far from where my folks live, because they live here close to where I do, and so we went to Stitches West, and I took some classes, and then I decided that I would also go to Stitches East, and for some reason I couldn't go to Stitches Midwest. I was gonna go to Midwest, but there was some other something that was happening. So I went to the TKGA show, which that year was in Branson, which was really close to where I was living at the time in Kansas City. And so I went to several shows and took a full load of classes at every show I went to with, you know, lots of fabulous teachers that are now many of whom, you know, my very close friends. And just learned whatever I could learn and realized how much I really was enjoying being in the industry. And by the time East hit, I had already decided that I was going to start my own knitting business. and was in the last, you know, steps of doing that. And so by the time the next Stitches West showed up, I had gone into partnership with the same friend out in California, and we were a vendor at Stitches West. So
you started out really as, went from a student to the vendor.
I went from student to vendor. And and that was the thing, because, you know, the teachers that were teaching were famous people. They were, you know, big names. They were, you know, people I'd been paying attention to and seeing their names in magazines and, you know, all sorts of stuff. So it never even occurred to me to teach or apply or even think about applying. But every once in a while, I was still now teaching, and pretty soon after this, it was within the next year or so, maybe two, at Kansas City, there was a new yarn shop opening, and I had been participating in the local guild, and one of my guild friends was going to be the manager, who is now a good friend and one of the other Stitches teachers, Cindy Craig. And so I went to start working with Cindy part-time. Because I was still doing, you know, knitability as my primary business, but there was, you know, time to do that. And so I worked on Sundays, and I also taught, you know, a variety of classes for them from time to time. And I'm still not exactly sure how the word got to Tracy, but Tracy came up to me while I was still just being a vendor at Stitches events, and Tracy said, "Hey, I hear you teach." And I said, "Oh, yeah. Yeah, I teach it locally, blah, 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 blah," you know. And she said, "Well, why haven't you ever applied to teach for us?" And it was like, because nobody knows who I am. <You know>? I mean, I really said that because it was the truth. And she said, "Oh, that doesn't matter." I was like, "Really?" And she said, "No, she says, you should apply." And I was like, "Okay." And so I applied. And the next event, you folks had me, you know, you did kind of what is your standard trick, which I've watched you do with lots of other teachers, is you have us teach a class or two, see how it goes, see how the reviews come, you know, kind of check and make sure that it's all working for everybody and kind of makes sense. And I think the next event I taught a few more classes, but in all these cases I was still vending. And then you basically asked me to teach a full load, and I vended for one or two more times. And had, you know, great helpers, Jean Abel being one of those great helpers to make that happen. A couple times it was Arliss, because he really is best husband ever. But that was just nutty, the whole trying to vend and teach a full set of classes when I'm really a business of one. I don't have employees that I can, you know, bring with me. That was just nutty. And what I really love doing is the teaching. And so I pretty much gave up all of the vending side of the business almost completely. So, and
well,
I don't regret it one bit.
I was going to say, it's hard to do too many things. And, you know, you are a lot, like a lot of us, we do too many things as it is. I have seen you so many times at Stitches up on a stage or in a classroom. And I want to talk about your style, because your style is very different than most people's style. It's extremely engaging. I know you're hyper organized, but I think a lot of it's ad lib. It just comes from these things that you believe in all the time. Can you talk to us about that a little bit?
Well, so there's a couple things. I've been paying a lot of attention to that recently, and part of it is related to, you know, my newest Craftsy class, which launched in January. Where I'm talking about how to teach, and I know that I have some natural teaching gifts, and there all of us have some natural gifts. I call it your superpower. I think everyone has a superpower. I don't think they necessarily good at identifying what it is, but there's things that we are just exceedingly good at, and we've kind of always been that way, and I know that there are some aspects of my teaching that are also my superpower, but I don't think that you have to have the superpower to be a good teacher. And so I've been trying to, you know, analyze kind of the, you know, what are my superpower parts of my teaching versus what are the you know, recreatable parts of my teaching that, that anybody can recreate. And I was raised, well, you met him, so you know. My dad is a storyteller. Oh, my gosh, oh, my gosh, oh, my gosh. And so I was raised with a storyteller, and I think that helps a tremendous amount in how informing my presentation style, because I am comfortable telling a story. And it was kind of brought home to me just this last Stitch of South, because I shared, you know, an illustrative story, as I often do in class. And as I walked around class to, you know, kind of check as people were working and whatnot, a woman stopped me, and she looked at me and she said, "That was the best story ever." Now, it wasn't that great of a story. You know, it wasn't like the best story ever, but she was like, "That was the best story ever." And I said, "No, really." And she said, "No." She said, "You are an amazing storyteller." And she was actually able to put her finger on what it was that she was seeing. And she said, "Because you're able to engage that story in a way that makes it extremely interesting." She said, "Because other people could tell the exact same story," and she says, "and it would have been a fine story and a great illustration," she said, "but it wouldn't have just been so funny and so engaging." She said, "You've got good timing. You understand how to tell a story." And I realized that that's what I learned from living with a storyteller my entire life and hearing lots and lots and lots of stories, many of them multiple times, and, you know, watching what, you know, really watching my dad work a crowd, you know, what works and what doesn't work. And and I think that that's a lot of what you see on stage and in class, is that I'm able to tell the story to engage people in a relaxing, you know, conversational kind of way. And sometimes they forget that they're in class and they're supposed to be all stressed out because they don't know what they're doing, which we don't really want them to be, but often that's how people, you know, enter class, with lots of tension and stress and whatnot. And so, but beyond that, my real superpower that I think truly is a gift, I mean, I learned storytelling from watching my dad, but my true superpower is I can speak extemporaneously pretty much about anything, for as long or as short as you want. And if I know just the tiniest bit about it, I can speak about it relatively intelligently. And the stuff I don't know, I can speak about in a way that says, "You know, I don't know this, but this is what I would think. What do you all think?" And engage people, and everyone's like, "Oh, yeah, cool. You know, she knows so much." And it's like, "Well, no, not really. I just told you I don't actually know that much about this." But so I think that's my superpower. I mean, that, it's an observation that Arliss has seen. He says, "Yeah, it's just amazing." And I figured that superpower out one Sunday a number of years ago. I walked into church, and our administrative assistant said, "Did Pastor Jay get in touch with you?" And I said, "Oh, no." I said, "I heard the phone ring, but we were, you know, I was in the shower," and said, "Yeah, he's sick today, and wondered if you could lead worship," which I will do leading stuff, you know, reading scripture and, you know, introducing people and whatnot. That's not a thing. And I said, "Yeah." And I said, "What was he speaking about?" And he said, and she said, "Well, he was just thinking we could do a hymn sing or something." And I said, "Well, what was he going to speak about?" And she said, "Well, this was the scripture and this was the general topic." And it was like, okay. And so I did a 20-minute sermon off the cuff with literally 30, 40 minutes of notice. And many people who've heard me do sermons, I've done sermons before, but they were much more prepared, you know, came up and said, "That was really fabulous." And I realized that that is my superpower. That's my gift.
I think there's something else to your superpower, too, because, and I've seen this in the best teachers, whether, and, you know, you're not alone in this, because I've seen, say, Betsy Hirschberg and Drew Emborsky and some other really talented teachers, but there is a method that you use with humor and just a way to make your students relax and to get them to forget about the stress. Some of it is employing things like a little self-deprecating humor. I remember once you were talking about an entrelock piece that you did, and guess what, folks, it's in Gwen size, you know. And
right.
there are little things that you do along the way that just break down the barrier between you and the student. So you're just having a conversation with a friend by the time you're all done with it.
It's interesting. Kelly and I have been working on our blog, and one of the things that we did, which just kind of came to me in a moment flash, was we did our About Us thing, you know, that we do on that people do on blogs, tell a little about. What we did is I wrote Kelly's and Kelly wrote mine, and so we wrote about how we perceive each other, and the last sentence reflects what you're saying here, so I'm just kind of going to confirm. I'm just going to read it to you. It says, when you walk by her side, you very quickly realize that she considers just about everyone either a friend or a future friend.
Yeah.
And I do. I believe that the world is basically good and that people are basically good, and there's no reason to assume that there's negative intentions, and so let's all try and be good together and be better together. And I've had to deal with the exact same things that all of you had to deal with in some form or fashion. I mean, you know, all of us have different paths, but even in the knitting, even though a lot of it came very, very easily for me, I understand what it's like to not know how to do something. I understand where it's, you know, frustrating and aggravating and all of those things. And so I can be in your shoes. I think when people realize that I'm not on a pedestal, that I'm much more like them than not, it becomes much easier to relate. And you don't get that error of, well, the reason I can't do it is I'll never be as good as Gwen. And it's like, well, no, fact is probably a lot of you in the room are better than me. I mean, we joke about being, you know, not very good knitters, but I'm not that great of a knitter. Not really. I don't spend near as much time knitting as a lot of the people in my classrooms do. I just understand and can explain what's happening and why it's happening and how to make it do it again or stop doing it or, you know, whatever thing. But I'm not that great of a knitter. There's lots of students in my classrooms that are way better knitters than I am.
Well, you have a lot to say. We'll talk about the technical aspect of it. One of the things that you had talked about a moment ago is how you can make anybody make this accessible. And you and I have talked many times that you tend to get a lot of young people in your classes. A lot of young people take your classes.
Yes, I do. And I know who you're thinking about. You're thinking about Austin, aren't you?
Well, Austin's been with you for forever. I mean, but you've had more than Austin too.
But Austin, you know, Austin's my greatest success story.
Well, why don't you tell our listeners about Austin?
So Austin, I met at Stitches Midwest a number of years ago. I can't even tell you how young he was. You may remember, but junior high-ish age, junior high-ish age, maybe sixth grade or something. You know, sixth or seventh grade, something like that. And his mom had taught him how to knit, and he was interested in taking knitting classes, and so mom brought him to Stitches Midwest. They live in the Chicago metro area. And so what mom had decided she was going to do is that she would come and be in all of the classes because she was concerned how some of the teachers might respond to the fact, first, that Austin was young, and second, that Austin was a boy, and, you know, how he would be treated. And she wanted to make sure that she was able to, you know, support him and give him additional information and whatnot as necessary. And they were in my class that was called Everything After Knit and Purl, which was designed for kind of the just beyond beginner. We made an oven mitt in class. And Austin was fabulous. He was already a fabulous knitter. I mean, he took instruction really well. The fact is, it's so much better to get people like under the age of 25 in class because their full-time job has been learning. That has been their full-time job. And so they still remember what it's like to learn. When you get people in that kind of 25 on up age, we start forgetting what it's like to learn. And we think we're supposed to know it all. And we get frustrated when it doesn't work right the first time. And it's like, well, you know, if you already knew how to do it, why would you be in class? Of course, it's not going to work necessarily the first time. And so young people learn almost always way faster than older adults do. And when I'm talking older, I'm talking like 30, you know, on up. And so, you know, Austin was just a sponge and did fabulous and, you know, came back the next year and took some more classes and, proceeded to keep on taking classes. And now, I don't know if he's probably a senior this year, maybe. I mean, it's amazing. Literally we have watched him grow yeah. up. His father's very tall, so he's a he comes in as this, little boy, and he's now this tall young man, and is designing these lace shawls that are just oh my gosh, amazing. You know, just fabulous, 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 amazing. And when he goes up for a student banquet to show things off, my very good friend and roommate at these Stitches events, Beth Whiteside's up there, and she always asks, because she just thinks it's funny, but who's your favorite teacher? Oh, Gwen. Gwen is my favorite teacher. And I love her. I love her because she does that just for me, just for my ego. She does it because she knows what the answer is going to be.
That's great.
I love having young folks in class because they really are sponges, and they almost always get way further because they're willing to fail, be okay with the failure, and then try it again. They don't have to get all hung up about, oh, but I'm not doing it perfect, and what if it's not just right, and, you know, because that's what learning is all about. Learning is about, you know, failing and figuring out what went wrong and what went right, and repeat the part that went right and don't do the part that went wrong and, you know, keep going. Because none of us, you know, popped out of the womb knowing how to walk. You know, it's the same process for everything.
Well, I completely agree. And let's segue into the other kind of teaching that you do. You've done a lot of live teaching, and you are also a very popular Craftsy.com teacher. What's that interaction with the students like? Because people, it's not a one-way thing. There's still a lot of interaction that you do with people through the help system there.
Right. It's a very interesting transition. And I just had a review done on a podcast called Craftlit last Friday. And Heather had taken the class, and she and I met through another forum, and I've said, oh, would you be willing to do a review? She says, oh, I'd love to do a review. And you know, she gushed about me, which is always nice to hear. But she totally gushed about me on the podcast. And what she gushed about was the fact that teaching in front of a live classroom and teaching for Craftsy is two completely different experiences, because you can't see right immediately what the students are doing. You don't get that feedback. You don't get that interaction to know, should you move faster, should you move slower, is there something you've forgotten to say that a student asked, yeah, but what about, you know, kind of thing. And actually, this was shared with me by Betsy Hirschberg when she did her filming at Craftsy. She said, Betsy has done lots of radio and TV kinds of things. I figured she would just totally eat up, you know, the Craftsy situation, because she was used to being around these kinds of environments. And she said, I had no idea how much I counted on the student interaction, which I thought was really interesting. Because while we're filming, we got none of that, none of it. We have, you know, usually three people in the room with us. Two of them are behind a camera. One of them is behind a bunch of computers. They're all wonderful, nice, professional people. There's nothing anyone I've ever heard anyone say anything negative about the filming experience there at Craftsy. They're fabulous. But it's not the same as a classroom full of students. And so you want to do your very best, but then, you know, at some point later when the class gets launched, then your students start arriving. And they arrive via this online forum. And it's the Craftsy forum is fabulous because there really is a sense of almost live, not quite, but almost live interaction, because students can, as they're watching the video, immediately start typing in their question at whatever point the question occurs to them, and then the instructors have a slightly different view that we're allowed to work from that helps us see questions a little bit easier, and then we can respond to those questions. And so it's still some very one-on-one kind of things, and some things are more generic, and some things are very specific. They can post a photograph. I've had folks say, you know, I think this is completely wrong. And I talk about, in my Entrelock class in particular, that, you know, Entrelock looks really wonky until you get going for quite a bit. So don't rip it out just because it looks weird, because it's probably right. And so I'll get from time to time that, well, this can't possibly be right photograph. And I write back, nope, completely right. Keep going. This is exactly what it's supposed to look like. So there's quite a bit of interaction that we're able to do with the students, although it's not actually live at the time. And I try at least to be on at least once a day. There's a few times that I'm completely out of, you know, connectivity service, but otherwise I'm usually on at least once a day, and often three or four or five, six times a day to check and see, because I love interacting with students. That's my favorite thing, and I don't want to leave anybody, you know, hanging if I can possibly help it. But the other thing that's great is because it's time stamped with where they are in the video, I can also click on that to see what their question is related to. I don't think I've actually got I don't understand what you just said, you know, kind of question, but if someone types that in, I could figure out what they were referring to, because I can click on the timestamp. It'll go back to where they started typing that, and I can, you know, run the video back a little bit and go, oh, okay, that's what that refers to. So it's a surprisingly wonderful, wonderful forum from that standpoint.
Oh, I agree. I've gone through a number of the classes there, and they're great. Now, of course, your first class there, I believe, was your Entrelock knitting class.
Yes, it was.
Gorgeous
just
class.
Just celebrated my one-year anniversary.
One-year anniversary.
Just a little over 1 year.
Very nice. Very nice. But your newest class is something that I'd like you to talk about, because the new class is how to teach it.
Correct.
Yeah. So what's the inspiration there? Was this your idea? Was this their idea? Can you talk about how this got going?
It's a class that is accumulation of a number of classes that I've been teaching at TNNA. TNNA being our trade show for the yarn shop and needlepoint retailers to come and buy wholesale, all, you know, and make their arrangements with their wholesale accounts, and they take classes as well. And so this has been one of my business classes, was, you know, how to teach whatever it is that you do, whether it be needlepoint or crocheting or knitting or, you know, anything, quite honestly. And I had classes on, you know, how to manage your shop classes and all sorts of things. And so what I had seen was Craftsy had started doing a series of, I think they call it their kind of semi-pro series, where it's folks that are wanting to move out of just being a hobbyist and maybe starting to make some income. And so our friend Edie Ekman had done a class called How to Say It, which was about doing pattern drafting, the actual words around the pattern. And I'm not going to say Fiona's name correct, her last name Guberstein. I'm going to say it really fast like it's okay. Had done one on pattern grading. There had been one on shooting, you know, taking photographs of your work. I mean, so there had been kind of a series of this. And so I approached Craftsy and said, you know, I have this whole series of things on, you know, and classes that we could consolidate to a class on teaching, how to teach. And I said the thing is, it's not about how to teach knitting. It's how to teach any handcraft, and the difference of teaching a handcraft as opposed to teaching a knowledge skill like, for example, mathematics. And the way to think about it, and how to lay out projects, and what makes a project a good class project, and we can talk about the business side of it, of business considerations, and we can talk about best practices and things that work. We can talk about managing difficult students, because unfortunately, occasionally we get those in class, and how do you deal with that professionally, but still make sure that the remainder of the students in your class have a good experience, and all of these kinds of things. And they pretty much jumped on it right away. By this time they had seen how my Ontolock class had done, and that had gone well, and they had worked with me already as a teacher, and so they knew what the filming experience was going to be like with me. But they were thrilled with the topic, and I've been thrilled being able to do it. It's one of those things that I believe very passionately that the more teachers of any handcraft, whether it be in the yarn industry or any industry, metalworking, I don't care what the handcraft is, we need more good teachers out there, because these skills used to be handed down, and in some cases they still are, but often that's just not the case, either because grandma doesn't live, down the street, and so I can't continue to get information from grandma, or grandma doesn't know how because she didn't learn. And so having people out there as teachers who are willing to, share their knowledge and their expertise allows these crafts to get continued on. And if we don't propagate a good supply of skilled teachers, when I'm saying skilled teachers, I mean teachers who are skilled at teaching their craft, then we're not going to be able to continue some of these crafts. And so that's been what my focus has been, and I'm really excited because we have all sorts of people in the class. It's not just knitting and crocheting. We've got, quilters, and we have embroidery people, and we have someone doing netting, and just all sorts of interesting handcrafts are taking the class.
Oh, well, I have not had a chance to see the class yet. I just previewed it, but it looked great so far, and I'm glad you're having success with it.
Yeah, no, I'm really happy with it, and I think it just will continue to grow, and it's one of those that just has staying power because it's kind of basics, And I'm guessing that it will continue to grow kind of forever because, new people come in and say, hey, I could teach this. And it's like, how would I do that? Oh, here's a class, And because I think that's how most of us decide in some point to become a teacher. I think very few of us, kind of have that as our goal. We get involved in a craft and we get really excited about it. It's like, hey, I want to start sharing that with people, Hey, I could teach this. What would that be like? And magically, we become a teacher.
So you consider yourself a full-time teacher, and I think that's wonderful. But you do some designing. You don't do a lot of designing. You've done some designing for us, and you are an author.
I am an author.
I'm
not sure if
book.
It was kicking or screaming, because I don't think it was. It was a book that needed to come out. I said from the beginning, I think I've got at least one book in me, and this was the book, and it needed to come out, and you and I chat from time to time, and I'm not sure there's a second book in me, and that's okay. I'm okay with that, but I'm really glad that I am an author of this book, and I'm really glad that I did it with XRX. I'm super glad I did
it
with XRX.
Thank you. It was a fun project, and along the way, lots of things happened, and there were new symbols that were created, and we started having fun calling each other bias knitters and all that kind of stuff. That whole first year that book came out was just really remarkable. And, I think it really invigorated people's interest in Ontolock again. It did a wonderful job being kind of a spokesperson for Ontolock.
Well, because I'm passionate about it, that makes it really easy for me. To be a good spokesperson for it. But I also think it has a lot to do with you folks at XRX. You guys drive a lot of what interests people. And that was part of the reason I wanted to be associated with XRX on this project, because I knew that you would do a great job in helping publicize the book, because I knew it was a technique that people wouldn't naturally be drawn to. It's not like, you know, socks or shawls. You know, those, ultimately those are kind of easy sells, because everyone gets excited about them. Ooh, socks, ooh, shell, you know, shawls. But entrelac, they're like, meh, been there, seen it, you know. It's a harder sell. Or it looks really hard, which it's not, but, you know, all of those things.
Yeah, it's a, it, well, yeah, I, we agree, obviously. So in case anybody's out there and is looking at Gwen's book, I've heard her do a presentation. She's going to give you some advice about how to deal with the book. Do you remember your advice about this?
Well, yeah, because I still give it when I do presentations about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that is when, soon after I had published it, people would say, so where should I start? Which I thought was just the doofiest question. I mean, it was so funny because it never occurred to me that you would start anywhere but the beginning. But as I thought then more about it, because it was, there wasn't just like one person asking this question, it came up kind of again and again and again. I thought about some of my other knitting books, and I went, oh, well, yeah, I can see that's a legitimate question. But I wrote the book as an instructor. And so you start at the beginning. You start at page one. Because page one is where there's great information. And the fact is, with most XRX books, you start at page one. Because that's the way Elaine, who's the R in XRX and the editor of the books, thinks. She thinks about it in an instructional kind of way. And so there's really great information at the beginning of the why and the how and the background and all of that stuff. And then for my book, and I think for a lot of the other books, because I've, you know, seen many of the XRX books, own most of the XRX books, they then do some easy projects and then some harder projects, and we build on what we've learned, and we, you know, we keep going on and on and on. And so the same thing is true for my book. Inevitably, someone wants to make, you know, the third thing from the back of the book, and they've never done entrelac before, and it's like, yeah, at least do some of the first things. You know, just do a couple of them before you jump into that. Because it, you know, the ones in the back are the harder projects. It's, you know, it's just as simple as that. The easier stuff's in the front.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And there's some kind of straightforward things in the front that give you the building blocks for the rest of the thing. So, yeah, it made all kinds of sense to me when I...
Yeah, no, it was perfectly logical. But like I said, when people, when I really thought about the question, it was like, no, I guess that actually is an okay question. But it was, but at the time, it was like, what? You start at page one, duh.
Can I ask you about your friends? You hang around with a group of
friends. Some of the best
friends.
People ever, don't I?
they really are pretty great people. They are, one, of course, you write a blog with, Two Sides of the Same Stitch. We've already referred to Cindy, who owns the Yarn Store. You've referred to Beth Whiteside. I have, I think, given you guys the nickname of either the Brat Pack or the Rat Pack, to which I think I've given you, you're Sinatra, I'm saying. But you hang around with these very creative, very generous designers, Sarah Peasley and Beth Whiteside, Cindy Craig, Kelly Nuss, and you guys bounce stuff off each other all the time. And I've been fortunate enough to sit with you guys, and it's just so creative. Can you tell us about that kind of environment and how it all came into being?
It came spontaneously, as all things kind of do. But I would bet if you were to ask any of the other gals, I mean, you know, there's several more that are kind of in the pack, as we would say. I would include Edie Ekman,
absolutely,
Myra Wood, J.C. Breyer. All of them are definitely, you know, in the pack. Michelle Hunter is our new addition to the pack. And what I think most of them would say is they would say that you're right, that I'm Frank, because I'm the central point that kind of drew people together. But it's only because I'm selfish, and I know it. I'm the first to admit it. People, oh, no, you're not. And it's like, no, really, I am. I'm extremely selfish. And so I just want to be around people that are really awesome. And so I find awesome people, and I make sure that they meet other awesome people that they then want to hang with too. And so then we start all hanging together. And ultimately, that really is how this kind of happened. And so we do hang together, and part of the reason that we hang together is because we do all have similar philosophies, I think would be the right word. We have the similar philosophies in the way that we teach, in the way that we share knowledge, in what really is a generosity of spirit, a willingness to share, and with one another and with other people. And so it becomes really easy to spend time with these people. And they're all fabulous. They're funny. I mean, it's an easy time to hang with these people. It's super, super easy. And we have the lovely convenience of seeing, you know, all of these people usually, you know, four times a year at least at Stitches. Some of them we'll see six and eight times a year because we'll be at other conventions and other events and whatnot. And at least for me, I see some of these friends that are, you know, all over the country more often than I see the friends that live here close to where I live, because I'm guaranteed to see them because we do these events together. So, but they're all, I mean, they're all very intelligent women. They all come from very diverse backgrounds. None of us came into this as a plan. I mean, you know, we don't have fashion degrees or art degrees or, you know, any of that. This was never the plan. It just kind of happened. But I think the most important part is that we are willing to share. We share with one another, but we also share with our students pretty freely and pretty easily when we're in classroom. And we also, I think this group also is really very strong on the there is not one right way. There are lots and lots and lots and lots of right answers. And so part of our sharing with each other is, so I've got these three right answers. Anyone got a fourth? You know, kind of a thing. My phrase that I use is, it's all about making your toolbox bigger. I want to have every tool available that I possibly can. I may not use some of them very often, but I still want to know about them.
Well, I've seen that that's always been your philosophy, and if I think back to the rest of the designers that you hang around, they're very much the same way. They all have different superpowers, as you would say. Sarah Peasley, for instance, you know, one of the greatest tech editors, or just editors, you know, that you can ever see, and funny, unbelievably funny.
Oh yeah, she's hysterical, but she is an amazing tech editor.
She is, yeah. I'd like to talk about one of your other friends, because you share a blog with her, and that's Kelly. And Kelly's got to be one of the sweetest people in the world.
She totally is. You and I both know a lot of really, really nice people, but yeah, Kelly's got to be on the top three list of anybody who knows Kelly.
But she's a very different style of teaching and presenting than you. I mean, she's well spoken. You guys make an interesting pair to have a blog. It really is kind of a point and counterpoint thing.
It is, and as we talked about it, that was really what it is. Our blog is called the address is thesamestitch.com, but the actual blog is called Two Sides of the Same Stitch. That was just too long to make as a URL, but. It's because we are like Knit and Purl. I mean, we talk about Knit and Purl like it's two separate things, but it's not. It is two sides of the same stitch. You can't create a knit without getting a purl. You can't create a purl without getting a knit. And Kelly and I find ourselves to be that we're exactly the same and totally opposite. And we find lots and lots of opposites, and we revel in each other's oppositeness. Is that a word? It is now.
It is now.
And so, I mean, because she lives on the East Coast, I live on the West Coast. She has five children, the youngest graduating, is it this year? Next year. Oh, gosh, I can't believe Evan's that old. She is right-handed, I am left-handed, I am extrovert, capital E, she is introvert, capital I. I mean, you know, the whole left brain, right brain, I mean, all of that stuff, we're very, very different. But where we're the same is we both care deeply, deeply about education, about building confidence in whoever it is that we're working with. You know, we particularly work with knitters, but it doesn't matter who we're working with. We want to build confidence because we see that as kind of the key. And that we're open to lots of possibilities, that there's lots of right answers. And so I have had several different blogs and have worked kind of through the blog thing for a while. And Kelly and I started talking about this, and first she kind of joined in one of my other blogs, and I said, let's make this more official, and let's, you know, kind of formalize this. And in the past few weeks, we've actually been making some changes and even making it more formal, because as she is finishing up her job as, you know, full-time mother, as her, you know, primary role, she's looking to be more and more involved in her professional life, and so we're looking at that together. But it's it really is a point and counterpoint, and she is very soft-spoken and super nice and super gentle, and most people wouldn't say those things about me.
Oh, I there's just a difference in style there. You're all generous. You and all your friends are very generous. Your time is, Kelly just has this very sweet, kind of very thoughtful way of dealing with things. I think you would agree with that. She's also a great writer.
Oh, she's a fabulous writer, which most introverts are, because that's part of being introverted and what the process is of being, that the thinking goes on in the head and then it comes out. And part of my superpower is that I am such a huge extrovert, because my brain engages as my mouth moves. And it doesn't necessarily engage that well unless it is moving.
Well,
I mean, it actually is a definition of an extrovert.
I will trust you on that. I, as you know, I'm not an extrovert. But I play one on Blog Talk Radio. But I really enjoy your blog. I tune in there a lot. You guys did a Stitchiversary column recently, and then you just did a podcast. I mean, it's just fun. If anybody, listeners out there, I really recommend you know, putting that on your blog list. It's called thesamestitch.com, and just back and forth between Gwen and Kelly. It's fantastic stuff.
Yeah, I mean, our general policy, and we don't completely adhere to this, but the general policy is we alternate days that we post, and so today is actually my day to post, and I was starting to work on that before we started, and so we go back and forth, and sometimes we'll be really good about, you know, one day Gwen, one day Kelly, and sometimes it'll be 5 or 6 days Gwen, and then one day Kelly, and then 3 days Kelly, and then one day Gwen, and you know, but it's fun. It's fun.
So what's next for you? Knitability does a lot of different things. So what's, you know, you offer, of course, teaching services and some design services, but now I see you moving toward the teaching of teaching, and I've also known that, you know, you're moving toward professional services. What's next for you? What's the next big thing for you?
Well, I've been I shared with you as we were kind of prepping for this that I have been home, I think when I'm, by the time I go to TNNA, I think it'll be 7. It may almost be 8 weeks home straight, which I can't remember the last time that happened. I travel, you know, all the time for teaching, which I love. I have no complaints about that at all. I mean, all of the, you know, people, oh, but I hate dealing with the airport and blah, blah, blah. None of that bothers me. I love the travel. I love doing it. Just doesn't bother me in any way, shape, or form. But this chunk of being home has just been kind of weird, quite honestly, in a good way, but just weird to be able to say I can focus, you know, on something and not be thinking about the next event, you know, that's coming up. And so I've been doing some of my own education, and because I love to be educated as well as to educate, but I don't get the opportunity very often because I am traveling and all of the other things. And so I've been taking a variety of classes that would be classified as professional development, and part of that is about trying to do some more online teaching, but through Knitability. I mean, I absolutely positively, given the opportunity, will teach for Craftsy anytime, anywhere, any topic they ever want, because I really love working with them and working with that forum. But not everything makes sense for their business model, and I totally get that. It makes perfect sense to me. And so I'm looking at developing some online classes that would not be appropriate for their business model, because there maybe is too narrow of a focus. It's not a topic that really falls into their strike zone. I mean, you know, there's all sorts of reasons why it may not work for them. And as part of that, I'm looking to expand more into doing business kinds of classes for small businesses and small craft businesses in particular, because I've got quite a bit of expertise in that area, not only from having run and developed my own successful small craft-based business, but also from all of my years prior as a consultant, both for Ernst & Young and in my own consulting firm. I was always working for the small business side. Even when I was working for Ernst & Young, my area of focus was small businesses. And so I have a really large wealth of knowledge that falls not only in the craft industry, but small businesses in general and business knowledge in general. And so I'm looking at applying that and expanding, you know, kind of out into that world. But some of my online classes that I'm looking at doing will also be knitting related. So it's not going to be all one thing or the other. But I'm excited about the possibility of being able to teach even more people. And I know that Craftsy has totally been the impetus for this, because I got so excited. One of my new, you know, kind of favorite fan/students is in Australia. And there's no way I would have ever met this woman if it hadn't been for Craftsy. And, you know, that's the beauty of, you know, online. And, you know, things like this. Anyone who understands English can listen to this podcast. Doesn't matter where they are. And I think that's cool. I just think that's really amazing. And I love what that reach means in the big scheme of things.
Oh, absolutely. So you see yourself moving into the future as professional services and consulting and things like this. Let's step back for a second. If you were to look at the industry where it is now, and, you know, where do you think the industry needs the most help?
The industry as the craft/hobby industry, and not just yarn, but, you know, any
right.
of the hobby industries, what I think continues to be the biggest issue is a lot of people who have started hobby-based businesses, whatever they are, often don't have much business background. They love what they do, which is great. You know, it's great to have passion. But there's so much more to running a business than the passion about the topic itself. Edie once, in her wonderful wisdom, Edie used to own a yarn shop, and every once in a while people would come to her and ask her about, you know, advice at starting a yarn shop. And her first question would be, so tell me how you would sell me a screwdriver. And I thought that was genius, because selling yarn's not about loving yarn. Selling yarn's about being able to sell anything. and that's the point, you know. And people are like, but I don't like screwdrivers. And it's like, yeah, I understand. But that's, you know, there's going to be a point you're not going to like yarn either, you know, when you're working in a yarn shop and, you know, owning a yarn shop, because some days it's just going to be miserable. But you've got to know how, what the sale is, even when it's not, you know, the thing that you just absolutely love, you know. And it's genius, because that's the truth of it. But Edie is a really good businesswoman, you know.
She is. So
that's the difference, is Edie gets business. And so I think that that's the issue, is that there is a need for lots of, I'm going to call it basic business help in the craft industry. You know, there are folks that are extremely successful. I'm not saying everybody needs it, but there are lots of folks who could use it, and some have really great potential because they do have a good eye, they have a good sense, they have, you know, good design or whatnot, but that's not enough to sustain a business long term. It may work for, you know, a year or two or three, maybe even four, but at some point that stuff starts failing because the business part isn't actually working. And unless you're doing the business purely, really doing the business as a hobby, where, you know, you've got someone else funding it and it doesn't matter if it makes money or, you know, any of the rest of those kinds of things, the business part has to matter. It has to be important.
Well, and I also think that one of the things that I think about professional development is, no matter how professional you are, you should always be taking some kind of class or learning something, reading a book or, you know, getting your mind out of your own industry and learning from something else. I mean, I think that's so valuable, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that was like why I was so excited about being home for a while, because I was able to do some of my own professional development. And one of the classes I took was a class on how to develop online classes. And the gal who teaches it, Diane from Crafty Pod, she's fabulous, just by the way, in case anyone cares. You know, she's doing other kinds of craft. She's not a knitting person. And it kind of cracked her up that I was in her class, because, you know, she knew I had already achieved as a Craftsy instructor, a multiple Craftsy instructor, an instructor on teaching for Craftsy, what many of her students would actually be wanting to try and achieve that were taking the class, you know. And I said, yeah, but there's other stuff, you know, there's always stuff to learn. And I was not disappointed. I mean, Diane had all sorts of really great stuff, and what I was looking for was more about how you do it on your own. And she's been very successful at doing online classes on her own. And so that was part of my education and what I'm now applying as I'm, you know, looking at moving into the future.
Well, that's fantastic. And you know, I want to wish you luck on that. I know it's going to be fantastic, and you'll let me know and make sure I stay in the loop on that, so I can make sure that we update our various social media apps. And when you launch it, I'd like to have you come on the show again so we can talk a bit about it, if that's okay.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know me, because like you said, you're an introvert and you want to listen, so you ask a question, and I'm an extrovert and I want to just yap at you.
it's a perfect relationship for you.
It is. It's a perfect relationship.
It's a perfect relationship. So before we wrap this up, I ask all my guests the same thing, which is an open-ended question. There are people listening. Some of them are consumers, some are business owners. Is there anything you'd like to say about anything to them?
Oh, that's an interesting question. So, yeah, let me say, it's going to probably be about three things, because it's kind of different groups of people. So for those listening that are hobbyists of any sort, whether you're, you know, kind of semi-professional or professional, but you still love your hobby, or, you know, whatever it happens to be, my number one piece of advice always is and always will be, take classes. I continue to be honestly shocked at the number of students that will show up in my class at any event, whether it's a local shop, a guild event, a Stitches event, you know, any other convention sort of event, and will say, yeah, I've been knitting for 50 years, and this is my first class ever. And it's not that, you know, they aren't good knitters, and it's not that they can't learn stuff in books, and it's none of that. It's about the whole interaction that goes on. Even if it's an online class, there's still an interaction, and you can learn things from other people's questions. The way I describe it is sometimes someone else asks the question that you didn't know you had. And so for anyone who's doing a hobby, find a way to take a class, whether it be at your, you know, local shop, through a guild, save up your money and, you know, go to your a bigger event, you know, and it may be something you can't, you know, do every year, but, you know, if you can do it every once every 3 years or 5 years even, you know, come and experience that, because there's so many little tips and nuggets and the experience of sharing an environment with other people who love the same thing. It's there's a really incredible energy there. Even if it's online, there's still an energy there too. So find a way to take a class, and you'll be surprised. There'll be something that you will learn that you would have never guessed you were going to learn, often that is kind of, you know, earth-shattering, and I love that. For business owners, what I would like to say is similar but different. Remember that it is still a business, and that you've got to treat it like a business. And even though you may, you know, love what you do and you love the yarn or you love your art or you love, you know, whatever it is, the love is not enough. You've got to figure out how to make the love become money. And there are great resources out there to help you figure out how to combine those things. You don't have to get rid of the love. I'm absolutely not saying that. I think the love is really important. But thinking about what you love about it, and how that can become money. If you aren't really doing that, if you aren't doing the money, then it's not really a business. It's still a hobby. It may be a really expensive hobby, but it's, you know, it's still a hobby. It needs to make money. It needs to make a profit to be a business. And focus, understand what that is. Understand how to do it. For myself, my big transition point was a number of years down the road of knitability. I said, you know, why am I putting all of this effort into this business that wasn't making any money at that point? It was still, you know, sucking money up, and it had been a number of years. And I realized what I loved was teaching. What I really loved was teaching. And so I refocused and said, okay, then everything we do that we're going to make money on needs to be around instruction and helping people gain more knowledge. And I kid you not, that was the year that I ended up making a profit for the first time. And it wasn't just because I loved the teaching. That was a huge element. It was a huge element to focus on what I loved. But it was also about, and how do I take that love and turn it into income and focus on that. And so that was part of the reason that I went ahead and bit the bullet to do the book, because I knew the book was a way to get the education out on Entrelac to a much, much broader audience. And then just to anyone who's listening, because they're listening, enjoy whatever it is that you do. One of the things that Kelly and I talk about, and Kelly is extremely insightful, it's one of the reasons I love hanging out with her, is, and she made me think about this, what I really care about is abundance. I think we all have abundance and we forget to see it. We get too worried about, you know, who's got a bigger car and who's, you know, got, you know, more money or a better job or a this or a that or whatever. And if we stop getting so focused on that and realizing all the abundance that we actually have, more abundance shows up. And so, you know, the same thing with our craft, with our hobby, with our life, with everything. Remember that we all have lots and lots of abundance. And be grateful for that and focus on the abundance instead of focusing on the lack, because really, there's more abundance. There really is, way more than we pay attention to. So there we are. That's my philosophy.
Love it. So before we head on out of here today, will I see you at TNNA?
You will see me at TNNA. I'm teaching some classes on Thursday and Friday, and we'll be walking the market floor all day Saturday and part of Sunday with Beth and Sarah and possibly Kelly. So the Rat Pack will be in full force, and obviously there won't be a way to miss us at all.
No.
Because
well,
if you can't see us, you'll hear us.
That's what I was going to say. And just for our listeners who don't get to TNNAs, where will be the next couple of places that you will be out in the world teaching?
I will be out in the world. My next place after TNNA, I will be in Indianapolis for TKGA, and that is toward the end of July. Let me just pull up my calendar here super, super quick so I can tell you exactly when that is. That it starts on the 18th through the 21st. And then I'm actually going to teach locally here in Merced the last week of July and the first few days of August for our local community theater kids program. I haven't taught locally and haven't taught kids in forever, so I'm kind of looking forward to that. That should be really fun. We're calling it playing with string, so it's not just knitting. It's going to be all sorts of, you know, yarny things. And then the next thing will be Stitches Midwest, starting on August 8th through the 11th. And I have to say, Midwest is my favorite venue to actually physically be at, because the Renaissance there in Schaumburg, man, is just, it is a perfect venue. It's, all of the classrooms seem close. I'm not quite sure how they do that, but they do. You know, the marketplace is not too far away. There is just buku amounts of wonderful seating to sit and knit, and it's all in wonderful space, and the hotel staff is nice, and there's always that really awesome flower arrangement in the lobby, and I, you know, it's just cool. So totally looking forward to that. So those are the next few things I've got going, and then once September hits, you know, then the nuttiness begins, and it'll get super busy again, which is fabulous.
Yeah. Well, so thank you so much for giving me your time today and for talking to our listeners. I really do appreciate your time. And again, once you get some of this other stuff on your video classes coming, I hope I can have you back on the show.
Well, like I said, always love to talk, love doing podcasts, and always love spending time and chatting with you. So that will not be any sort of burden on my part at all. And thank you so much for having me. You said, it took until 11 episodes, but I'm still really honored, like, you know, that I'm in the first 25, you know. So I am thrilled to be on, and I appreciate you including me in your new podcast. I think it's wonderful, and I've enjoyed listening to it, so I'm thrilled and honored to be on it.
Thanks very much, Gwen. So that was Gwen Bortner. Make sure you keep up with her by visiting her website, knitability.com, and thesamestitch.com if you want to read her blog with Kelly Nuss. Those are both ones you're going to want to bookmark, and we'll make sure that we put them up on our Ravelry group. Next week, my guest will be Lindsay Martin of Erin Lane Bags. Lindsay is an eighth-grade teacher by day and organizational superhero by night. We're back into the superhero thing. She founded Erin Lane with her mom 4 years ago with just 5 products, and since exhibiting at their first Stitches, they now have 19 products that organize everything from notions to large blanket projects. Lindsay is charismatic. She is outspoken. She is more interested with what's real than what is politically correct. And the way she expresses herself can be a lot of fun. She is someone that I find an absolute breath of fresh air in the business community and of our industry. And this should be a lot of fun, this interview. I hope you'll join us to see what she will say. I know I'm already curious about what she might say. For those of you who have missed anything in this podcast, I invite you to join us on our Ravelry group, Fiber Hooligans. Our moderator, Tammy Burke, always does a great job of making sure that she answers questions and posts interesting links to anything we might talk about. I also wanted to make sure that you know that I'm eager to hear from you. You can email me questions, recommendations, critiques, and feedback to benjamin@fiberhooligan.com. I don't promise to respond to every email or message, but I do promise to do my best to read them all. If you ask me a really great question or have an inspired idea, or just because I'm feeling feisty, I may even read your email or message on the podcast. And with that, we come to the end of our show. I wanted to tell you again that I missed you. It was a nice break, but I'll try to keep these breaks few and far between because I like hanging out with you Fiber Hooligans. So that's our show. As we slide on out of here today, I'd like to wish you all a glorious week. Remember, the only thing better than being creative is being kind to each other. And the good news, you can do both. Thank you for spending this time with us. I'll see you next week on another edition of Fiber Hooligans.